Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning, 4 minutes past the hour. Welcome to a Tuesday morning underway from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Honored to be with you weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central, as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Speaking of hopeful and helpful all at the same time, later this morning we're joined by medical doctor, Dr. David Stevens. He's with the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. Those are the largest professional associations of Christian healthcare professionals here in the U.S. Dr. David Stevens weighs in to talk about, some of the concerns that have emerged across our country, some disturbing trends in many respects as it regards so-called healthcare reform, the federal government takeover of the medical profession and the insurance industry and the healthcare industry and such. Dr. David Stevens weighs in a little bit later this morning. He is such an insightful and a breath of fresh air. It's such an insightful man. And so we look forward to talking with him a bit later this morning. Also, we welcome back yet another doctor. We're flush with doctors, people with the title doctor today as guests on the program. Dr. Kent Kaiser. That would be Kent Kaiser, Ph.D. He is a professor here where our network is headquartered at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. Dr. Kent Kaiser, a professor of rhetoric and speech communication. He'll be with us later this morning to evaluate some of the rhetoric. I mean, this is kind of rhetorical analysis, and I think it's worthy of our attention. He'll be with us to evaluate some of the rhetoric coming from would-be U.S. presidents. My goodness, that's a broad and vast category these days. Would-be U.S. presidents. There are a lot of people running for the presidency right now, especially on the right side of the aisle politically here in the U.S. And if you're in Canada, we love you, and this is kind of American family business here, but it really does matter for Canada and the world who becomes our next president. So Dr. Kent Kaiser will weigh in specifically on the launch of I guess we could say three minor presidential candidates' campaigns, kind of all at the same time, all simultaneous. Not surprisingly, but Dr. Ben Carson, M.D., Dr. Ben Carson, M.D., the noted neurologist from John Hopkins Medical Center in Maryland. Dr. Ben Carson, he launched his campaign officially just recently. So also did former tech exec Carly Fiorina, who has a fascinating new book out. I know Carly Fiorina just a couple of months ago was an interview guest here on the Faith Radio Network. I believe that was Neil Stavem's program, the Connecting Faith program, where Carly Fiorina was a guest. And along with that, doctor and lady executive, we've got Reverend and former Governor Mike Huckabee. And don't forget, Mike Huckabee actually, I believe he still has church ordination, but before he became an elected official, before he ever got elected governor of his home state of Arkansas, he was a pastor. And all three of them are talking very openly about their Christian faith, about their church ties and allegiances, and so forth. So Dr. Kent Kaiser will offer up some analysis on that coming up a little bit later this morning. So all of this and more is just ahead here over the next little less than 2 hours now here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. Now, when we come back, it's very interesting that we have this guest scheduled on a day such as this. Here, the lead news story, as reported to us by our friends at SRN News, our network news feed supplier. You heard it there at the top of the hour. The news feed, the lead story, was that tragic shooting and what appeared to have been an attack on an assembly of people in the state of Texas. The Islamic State terror group, the rogue quasi-military operation, is claiming responsibility for that. They are saying that was our first attack on American soil, organized attack on American soil, and Americans get ready, there are more coming. Could it be that we have problems with bullies in the adult population? When we come back, our great friend Paul Coughlin, who has written a striking book about raising bully-proof kids. He consults to parents and schools all across the country. He's going to weigh on this issue, not of the Islamic State necessarily, but this broader issue of adults who bully one another. What's the Christian perspective on that? Paul Coughlin, my guest, coming up next. It's now 9 minutes past the hour. From the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill.
Getting your day started, connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the morning.
It's now 10 minutes past the hour. I am Austin Hill. Glad you're with us. What if you were to hear of a book entitled Raising Bully-Proof Kids? Wouldn't that sound like something you'd want to pick up, something you'd want to know about? Well, chances are you have heard of that book before. Its author is a gentleman named Paul Coughlin. He also heads up an organization called The Protectors. He's been with us on our program before, talking about protecting kids from bullies in their campus environments. But what if you were also to learn that bullying, while sometimes the word is misused, bullying actually happens in our adult relationships as well? On our guest line, once again, we welcome him back to the program to clear the air and give us some wisdom to us, Paul Coughlin from The Protectors. Paul, welcome back. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
It is great to be with you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Do we sometimes in the adult world kind of misuse and maybe even overuse the term bully?
Yeah, it's, to the point, we would do better to have a different name. Bullying stems from disdain and contempt toward another person, and it's not about conflict or misunderstanding, two people who can't get along. It's someone with superior power that uses it intentionally to harm another person over time and for no good reason. It's victimization without provocation. This poor kid, or in this case now, this adult, doesn't deserve it. Most bullies look for nice people to go after because a bully is not looking for a fight. A bully is looking to overwhelm, and nice people are easy to overwhelm. Nice Christians, in particular, are easy to overwhelm.
So, therefore, bullying as such, the term, does not apply to maybe a real aggressive competition on the court or on the playing field or even in the business marketplace. If people are on equal footing and they're competing aggressively, they may get nasty about it, but that's not necessarily bullying.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, as I wrote for Fox News, they said the word should be removed from the sports page. One team does not bully another team. It just doesn't happen. It's really more interpersonal. They may smash another team. You know, I'm a boys varsity soccer coach. We've won games 15-2, and it's not bullying. We didn't do it to intentionally harm the other team over time and for no good reason. We just beat them.
And okay, your point's well taken. Now, that said, you have blazed a trail, Paul Coughlin, at least in my estimation, awakening people, and I would say especially Christians, but even in the broader culture, awakening people to the problem of true, authentic bullying on school campuses. But I also understand you're suggesting, and you used the term earlier, interpersonal. You're saying that adults can bully one another in interpersonal ways. Tell us about that.
Well, they do. I mean, I think as people are listening now, someone is coming to mind, you know, in their life. Usually it's a family member, and or it's a coworker. It could even be a neighbor. And these are people who use threats and accusations when you're around them. Now, some are better at it than others, but these are the people that once you leave their presence, you have found yourself kind of sucker punched psychologically. These are people who, and it took me a long time, Austin, to understand this. I am just not the kind of person who's going to go to a family gathering or social gathering with an accusation on my lips, ready to go and take a shot at someone.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't do that. Most people don't do that. Bullies do that on purpose. They are figuring out their opening shot against you before they ever get to you. It is intentional. It just didn't come off the cuff. They've probably been planning it for a long time. And that is how these people are. It's premeditated. They want to score some points off of you when you're in a social gathering. They want to make you feel uncomfortable. They want you to feel stupid. Mm-hmm. And they're going to do that if they have an opportunity. And most of us nice Christians, we have what I call the niceness doctrine. I wrote the book, No More Christian Nice Guy, because there's a big difference between being nice and being good. Most of us go into the world with the niceness doctrine, and that it goes like this. If I'm going to be nice to you, you owe it to be nice to me.
Right.
Now, most people play ball with that. Bullies don't. Bullies take niceness and even gentleness and kindness that you're a sucker, and they will turn it against you. They will take your niceness, in a family gathering, and they'll take your nice words, and they will just use them against you. They usually have pretty good verbal acumen, because most bullying it's verbal, it's not physical.
Mm-hmm.
People who continue with physical bullying, they end up in jail. So we're not talking about those people. We're talking about the people who do mostly verbal bullying. So they want to intentionally take a shot at you. And we actually have a very foolish approach toward them. The Bible tells us that only a fool shows their true feelings in certain situations. And what we do is we show our true feelings in those situations. We need to disguise how we feel and how we think. And we need to approach those people the same way we approach a corner in a car. There's three parts to a corner. There's the entry, the corner itself, and then there's the exit. I used to race bicycles, so corner is really important. Otherwise, you end up with broken collarbones.
Sure.
And that's what we need to do. We need to look at our interaction with bullies. It's a three-part interaction, and if you handle those three parts well, you're going to come out the other side of it way different than you are currently doing it, which is usually miserable.
All right. Paul Coughlin, stand by. Let's talk about handling those things well as we continue. Paul Coughlin is my guest. Yes, he wrote the book about raising bully-proof kids, but he's giving us some insight about bullies among us in the adult population. 17 past the hour. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill.
Back to Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
Good morning, 19 past the hour. I'm Austin Hill. Glad you're with us. Paul Coughlin, he heads up a group called The Protectors. He counsels and consults schools really all over on the problem of bullying on school campuses. He's written a very eye-opening book called Raising Bully-Proof Kids. So where's the first place that the adult needs to start, Paul Coughlin, when it comes to examining our adult relationships and identifying the bullying problem and changing our ways?
Yeah, we owe everyone a base level of respect and dignity because they're made in the image of God. Even the jerks in our lives, we owe them some level of dignity and respect because they're made in the image of God, not because of the way they act.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't owe everyone the same treatment. We just don't. We don't treat an infant the same way we would treat a tyrant. And we're allowed to treat people differently. Yet we're not allowed to do an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We're not allowed, and that's probably when Jesus was talking about such things. But I think what he was telling us, particularly with turn the other cheek, is first of all, being slapped on the face is not a mortal injury. It's an insult. And he's probably telling us that when someone insults you, do not respond in kind. Do not get into revenge. So what I'm talking here is not revenge. And at the same time, it's also not the niceness doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhere in the middle, which is the more healthy and probably biblical view. And we need to know that in the blacksmith of our soul, that this person is not with me. This person actually is working against me. And we need to know that and be convinced of that, because you don't treat those type of people the way you would treat intimates. We should only allow people who are healthy and life-affirming into our inner circle. These people do not fit that category, and let's not play games. they don't fit that category because they aren't in that category. They're another kind of person.
Right.
So we must know that they are actually against us when we are in their presence. And to handle them effectively, again, it's the entry, the encounter itself, and then the exit. When we find ourselves moving in their presence, usually it's in a room, usually that's someone's house or something like that, you need to enter the room with an air of confidence, not arrogance, but an air of confidence with a slight smile on your face, standing up straight, making eye contact with most people, and with the bully in your life, make eye contact, but don't make it long. Look at them. Nod your deal, say something if you want to, but move past them if at all possible. You do not owe your bully candor. Do not give them personal information about your life because they're going to ask. I guarantee it. They're going to go fishing when they see you. You do not owe your bully candor. Jesus only answers like 5 questions directly in all the Gospels. Most of the time he doesn't answer the question.
Right.
Most of the time he responds with a question of his own. And then he says to Pilate, are those your words or did someone give them to you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty powerful language right there. So Jesus didn't give everyone a candid answer, and neither do we owe a bully a candid answer. So enter with confidence. It helps to have a person by your side.
Right.
Confidence grows. Encourage grows with a person by your side. Okay, so you're entering the room with confidence. Before you didn't. You're all worried. Your eyes are darting around. This is how most people treat when they know they're going to be in the presence of a bully. And then the encounter itself. Keep it brief. Do not answer long, long questions, and don't provide a long answer. One thing, and I've done this recently, by the way. I did this month with someone who was not in my corner, and I know it. And I answered a question that he said with, where did you get that information?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew that didn't work well for him, and I said it on purpose. But then here's the other thing. I abruptly ended the conversation. I said, excuse me. And I walked away to go talk to someone else. Now, most people think that's, I don't know, un-Christian. There's nothing wrong with that at all. You're not dealing with an intimate, and you're certainly not dealing with someone who is in your corner. This person is working against you.
Mm-hmm.
So you show a basic level of respect, but then you move on. Do not, for whatever reason, targets feel that it's necessary to stay tethered to their bully. It's an odd thing. It probably has something to do maybe with codependency. Not exactly sure what it is.
Right.
But it's not right. Abruptly end and move on to something else. And if at all possible, you can turn your back as you walk away from that bully. It means a lot. It's something you didn't do before.
Yeah.
And then here's the other thing. Now we have a successful entry. We have a successful encounter. Leave early, if at all possible. If it is to your benefit. If you need to stay and it's to your benefit, well, then stay. But if you've already accomplished what you've set out to accomplish, go ahead and leave.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important. Bullies are going to want to take a second shot.
Yeah.
They've taken their first shot. It didn't work. And, in fact, you've really perplexed them now because they've been able to get under your skin in previous encounters. They couldn't do it this time. And because now you have a game plan. It's important to be 2 steps ahead of your bully.
Right.
And they're not thinking you're 2 steps ahead. They're thinking you have fallen into their trap so many other times. You're slipping out from under their control. They're going to try to take another shot at you. If you can, exit gracefully and abruptly, if at all possible,
mm-hmm.
be a little different than you were before. And in many cases, they don't know what to do with that.
Paul Coughlin is the man who heads up a group called The Protectors. His book, one of them anyway, is entitled Raising Bullyproof Kids. He's offered us some insight as to how to deal with the authentic bullies in our lives as an adult. Paul, implicit in everything you're saying, and it points at it's explicit too, but part and parcel of what you're saying here is that our choice of the words we use, our choice to limit our words, our choice to not speak words at all at times, our physical gestures, our body language, our physical movement, all of that conveys something about us to the prospective bully, and it conveys to other people how we expect to be treated. Is that an accurate read of what you're getting at here?
I think you just came up with a maxim there that is absolutely spot on. Bullies, most of how we communicate, certainly in social settings, is with body language, nonverbal language. And bullies do not, contrary to what most of us think, they don't pick a fight with everyone. We kind of wonder, this person must be this way all the time. They're not. They're like the leader in the movie Whiplash. If you ever saw that movie, that is just a quintessential bully. Pushes around people, but some people, but not others. His act is very charming in front of other people. So they're looking for people who they're pretty sure they can get away with it. And if you think about it, and I'm going to go back to family because this is where it's usually most painful. Have you noticed that the bully in the family doesn't go after everyone? Think about it. There's certain people, in most cases, most of the time, they don't go after. Why? Because they're pretty sure they can't dominate that person, and that person's going to push back.
Right.
So they tend to leave that person alone, but they go after the others. So, for example, this month when I entered the room, I knew this person was going to be in there. I put a slight smile on my face. One thing you can do, too, is you just slightly drop your eyebrows when you see this person. You still have a smile on your face, but it's a very... It's a confident smile. You're not wide-eyed scared when you're looking at it, which is how you've been in the past. And you just give them a kind of a knowing smile. I know who you are, and I ain't playing your game anymore.
Right.
It makes a huge difference. Now, the problem is, Austin, most nice people just don't think they have it in them to do it. And you really do have to screw your courage on early. And you will be amazed how much power you have by saying nothing.
Yep. All very important ideas. Paul Coughlin, we've got him on our network website at myfaithradio.com, reference to his website and his book as well. Paul, thank you. You are a voice of reason in troubled times, one of the few, and I look forward to, I hope you'll come back and join us again real soon as bully problems proliferate all around us.
They sure do. Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me.
28 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central. Weekdays at 12 noon Central. It's the Connecting Faith program with host Neil Stavem. Yesterday, Neil interviewed author Dr. Richard Melheim as they talked about his book, Holding Your Family Together, 5 Simple Steps to Bring Your Family Closer to God and to Each Other. Here's part of that discussion.
Oxytocin, which is the female bonding drug, is released in great washes at birth. And even a woman who has never entertained a single motherly instinct in her life, there's something that happens when the receptors pick up that oxytocin, and it's, you know, I love this child. I don't even know it, and I love this child. So one could say God has built into us from that start the bonding that's going to happen.
Say more about the term bonding. I think we're well aware of that, but what does that actually, I guess, look like? And, you know, we're in a society now where parents oftentimes, because of responsibilities working or having others, spend a lot of time with their children.
From the holding and the touching and the fun and the love and the nurture that a mother gives to her child. Nursing, if you can do it, is very beautiful, but it's also immunologically very important for the child to give the child what they need. Some women can't breastfeed, and that's one thing. But in order to be confident, con means with and fide, with faith in life, in order to be compassionate, and the word compassion is the word com, which means with, and passion, like the passion of Christ, literally to suffer with, to have true empathy. In order to have sympathy and empathy and compassion, in order to see the world as a net plus instead of a net, I don't get what I need, so I'm going to grab everything I can. We need to bond with the role model, and the first one God gave us, the first one God gives us are our parents. We can do a whole show on fathers and how important fathers are in kids' lives later if you want. But the mother has that special relationship that will give that kid the ability to launch out into the world. If you put a child in a in a swimming pool to swim and they don't have something strong to hold on to, they'll just flail about and drown. If they have something strong to hold on to, they can push off, and they will, especially in adolescence. But they know they have something to come back to. And I like to say you can't come back to a place you've never been. And if you want to have the prodigal who knows they can come home because they know they'll always be taken back in, they may test you and they may best you and they may mess up your life for a few years. Freud defined adolescence as temporary mental illness. But if they have that solid foundation, and of course, train up a child in the way he shall go, and when he is old, it doesn't say when he's 16. In fact, it doesn't even say when he's 24, but when he is old. God's given us such clear answers in this amazing book, His Word, and it's good to follow the directions if we want the best for ourselves and for the people we love.
That was from yesterday's episode of Connecting Faith. Coming up on today's episode, Neil Statham speaks with author Dana Gresh about her book, Lies Young Women Believe. Today, 12 noon Central, it's the Faith Radio Network Connecting Faith with host Neil Statham. I'm Austin Hill. In minutes, Greg Yoder, Executive Director from Mission Network News. Stories of Christians around the world. We'll catch up with Greg in moments. SRN News, headline news on the way next. Good morning. It's 39 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Great to have you with us. I'm your weekday mornings as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, helpful here at the start of your day. We don't shrink from the day's news. We take a look at it. We try to see the issues of our day through the lenses of our Christian faith. Let's talk for a moment about the turmoil that is the nation of Nepal. It's very interesting how quickly crises and tragic events just dissipate, just go away from the dominant news headlines here in the United States and throughout much of the Western world. Even if they disappear, that doesn't mean that they aren't still serious crises and worthy of our attention. Our great friend Greg Yoder is with Mission Network News. He joins us on our news line here at Faith Radio to talk about rescue efforts in Nepal and other items. Greg, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Hey, great to be back with you this morning.
Good to talk to you. According to Mission Network News, missionnews.org, still thousands of people are just unaccounted for in the country of Nepal. What's the latest there?
Well, I just read that there were about 7,300 people that have now lost their lives in this earthquake. Now, there are a lot of people that haven't even been reached yet, especially near the epicenter. Epicenter was about 50 miles northwest of Kathmandu, and it's a very rural area. And so I know that a lot of people have been able to make it into some of the areas, and they're talking about some of the towns were utterly and completely decimated. I mean, just completely wiped out, just a bunch of rubble. And we're finding out that the villages, people in those villages, literally 70% of the villages, they're gone. Or they're dead. And so we're hearing some of those reports. And we're going to be getting more and more of those reports in, probably as these rescue crews are able to get in there, more than likely, especially as relief aid is kind of pouring in. It's pouring into Kathmandu. Organizations like Gospel for Asia, they have 450 churches in Nepal, and six of those churches have been utterly destroyed. Also, when you think of child rescue centers that are in Nepal, they have some of those as well. And many of those, believe it or not, didn't even lose any children, which to me is just phenomenal.
That's miraculous.
Yeah, I know. It's almost miraculous that anybody, or especially all those churches, survived, because the earthquake, it actually hit during worship services. They hold worship services on Saturday in Nepal, and so it's just absolutely amazing that none of their pastors were killed.
That is extraordinary indeed. 7.8 magnitude earthquake, as I understand it, Greg Yoder. And when the quake originally struck, a lot of analysts were saying this is the worst earthquake anywhere on the planet since the year 1900. Are those monumental figures still accurate so far as you can tell?
Well, I've seen worse earthquakes in terms of their magnitude, but not in terms of destruction, because many of these buildings were built on 100-year-old infrastructure. So you have some wooden structures, you have structures that were made of brick but no mortar or no rebar. So you've got a lot of structures that just couldn't withstand that kind of shaking. I mean, you think of even the Haiti earthquake. The Haiti earthquake was worse than that. But there have been, obviously, there are a lot of disasters. And I think it all ultimately amounts to how deep they were within the Earth's surface. And I'm no earthquake seismograph geologist. So I couldn't tell you if it's the heaviest one or the worst earthquake. But in terms of devastation, I mean, you think of all the devastation that took place there in Nepal. It's pretty amazing. And one of the rarest pieces of video actually taken by Wycliffe Associates, they're actually on the ground doing Bible translation in Nepal. And they were on the ground within just a minute or so after the earthquake, probably one of the highest parts of Kathmandu, taking video of what took place during the earthquake. And to watch it is unbelievable. I mean, the aftermath is just surreal. And all of the birds that are in the air, just unbelievable. It reminds you of the movie The Birds.
Very interesting. Greg Yoder is the executive editor at Mission Network News, missionnews.org, if you want to find him. That's a nonprofit news agency that reports on the plight of the suffering church, not always the suffering church, but the church around the world that oftentimes suffers, especially in the third world. He's headquartered here in the United States. He's with us on our newsline on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. Very interesting data that you're reporting about orphans around the world, to shift gears here just a little bit. Now, we frequently speak with a group called the Christian Alliance for Orphans. I know you're well acquainted with them, Greg Yoder. And you put together a news report at missionnews.org about some stats that the United Nations is reporting. Pretty devastating news, potentially devastating anyway, about the number of children that just don't have any adult leadership whatsoever in their lives. And you're pointing out, sort of juxtaposing the data about orphans from the UN and saying, but here's what Christians are doing about this problem. Tell us about that.
Well, when you look at the number of orphans around the world today, I mean, you think of orphans coming into, just becoming orphans. There are, of every 18 seconds, there's another child that becomes an orphan. And today, 130 million kids are considered orphan. Now, that's either they lost a father or a mother. So when you look at those types of scenarios, and you understand and you see some of the things that are taking place around the world with these kids, and many of them becoming trafficked with sex trafficking and just being trafficked, human trafficking, getting involved in that area, you understand what's going on, because there aren't a lot of people that are getting actively involved in the orphan crisis. So, I mean, what's happening here in the United States is that there are a number of groups that have gotten together and formed a coalition to try to address some of these issues. And so each year they have a summit that takes place in Nashville, Tennessee, to encourage just the average people that are interested in taking care of the orphan crisis, not just here in the United States, which there is one, by the way. 400,000 kids are involved in the foster care system, and many of those kids age out of the system without ever getting a mom or dad, and many of those kids actually end up on the streets. And so we do have a problem here in the United States, too. And so these groups are getting together, bonding together, and trying to get churches to form some type of an orphan ministry so that they can have an impact on these kids. Because let's face it, I think James 1:27 said it very well, you know, that true religion is taking care of the widows and the orphans. And so we have a responsibility to do that. And many Christians are doing that.
Greg Yoder, executive director and weekday anchor at Mission Network News. He's on our news line here at Faith Radio. Greg, stand by for a quick moment. I've got one more question for you. We'll continue with Greg in moments as he updates us on the plight of Christians around the world. It's 47 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network.
News you can use. Connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
It's now 51 minutes past the hour. Greg Yoder from Mission Network News. He's on our news line here from the Faith Radio Network. Greg, real quick, I wanted to ask you to comment about the nation of Russia. For the first time ever, to my knowledge, Russia has been placed on a list of nations to watch for violations of religious freedom. What in the world is going on here?
Well, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom issued their report. Now, back in 1998, this commission was formed by Congress and by actually the President. President Clinton signed the legislation. Mm-hmm. And it's basically to kind of keep tabs on religious freedom in various countries around the world. And they issued their annual report last week. And yes, for the first time, Russia is now one of the lists, one of the countries to watch on the list. Now, they're tier two, which means they have some issues. They need to address some issues, and if those issues are addressed, they won't get to the point where sanctions and so forth are issued. But Russia is on that list, and it's basically because of a couple things. One, they've established some legislation that basically deems people who receive funding from outside as foreign agents. So they're kind of like spies. So you can see the problem with missionaries getting money from the outside. And then secondly, in eastern Ukraine, many of these Russian separatists have gone in as Orthodox militants and saying, if you're not an Russian Orthodox, we're going to do some things to you. And they've basically destroyed churches, they've kidnapped pastors, tortured them, and have even killed some of them. And so that's the response that we're seeing right now. And much of this has been done by the approval of Kremlin.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Here in the U.S., of course, we have just always lived in an environment, you and I, where there is a distinct line of separation, so to speak, between church and state. And this is one of the reasons why, it would seem to me, why the founders of our nation wanted the church, to not be funded by and affiliated with any government, because if a church is funded by the government, it becomes kind of a tool for the government officials and their political ambitions. Are we seeing, it sounds to me like we are seeing an overt politicization of the Russian Orthodox Church. It's almost becoming sort of a force of the Kremlin and the military. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a very fair assessment. We're seeing that consistently. In fact, the Orthodox Church is basically in bed with the Kremlin, and you're seeing both sides of the palms being greased in that area. Legislation is being supported by that. When you look at the evangelical church, they continue to be viewed as sects and cults within that culture, which is kind of interesting, because in some of these areas where there's humanitarian need, especially along the Ukraine or Russian border and in the southern portions of the Muslim parts of the Stan regions, that's where there's a lot of humanitarian need, and the evangelical Christians are the ones that are actually reaching out and doing something. The evangelical Christians are the ones that are actually taking care of the widows and the orphans. And so there is a dichotomy within the culture that's, you know, obviously the Orthodox Church is very powerful, but the evangelical church is growing.
Greg Yoder, Executive Director, missionnews.org is where you can find him. Greg, tremendous work on behalf of yourself and your associates there at Mission Network News. Thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning. We appreciate the insight, and we look forward to talking again very, very soon.
Well, it's a pleasure. Been a privilege. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you. 54 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. It's Tuesday. I'm Austin Hill. Five past the hour. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday mornings, weekday afternoons from the Faith Radio Network. It's Susie Larson with her program, Live the Promise. Yesterday on her program, author and Bible scholar Ron Rhodes stepped in to answer tough questions about the Bible. Here's part of that discussion.
Jim's calling from Solon Springs. Am I saying that right?
That's correct. I'm just wondering if Ron's studies have convinced him of the rapture either being pre-tribulation, mid-tribulation, or post-tribulation?
Well, in fact, I do have a view on that, but before I answer that question, I always like to tell people that we can all agree to disagree in an agreeable way on this debate, because I know Christians feel very personally on their prophetic viewpoints. So let me tell you why I'm a pre-trib. I approach Scripture from basically a pretty literal standpoint, and that basically means that when the plain sense makes good sense, seek no other sense lest you end up in nonsense. And by following that kind of a plain interpretation, it seems to me from 1 Thessalonians 1:9 and 5:9 that God has promised to deliver the church from the wrath to come. And there's a definite article before the word wrath, the wrath to come. It is a specific period of wrath yet to come. And so I believe that God is going to deliver the church from the future tribulation period by taking the church out of the world before then. I also look at every single passage in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that deals with the tribulation period, and the church is not mentioned a single time. We also see that God has a long track record of delivering his people before judgment falls. I think about Rahab and the spies being out of Jericho before judgment fell on Jericho, and I think about Noah and his family being rescued before the flood, and Lot getting out of Sodom before the judgment fell on Sodom, and I could just give many examples. Likewise, I think the church is going to be protected and taken out of the world before the judgment falls in the tribulation. And when you think about it, why would God punish the church? Our sins have already been punished by the death of Christ. Christ is going to be punishing the sins of the unbelieving world during that tribulation period. Now, having said all that, I've got some friends who are mid-tribs and post-tribs and also who hold to the pre-wrath theory, and I love them all. We get along just great. And you know one of the reasons for that? We agree on a lot more than we disagree on. We agree on Jesus and the Holy Spirit and the nature of salvation. We all agree that the second coming is going to happen and the judgment is going to follow that. We all agree that we Christians are going to be with the Lord forever in the New Jerusalem in heaven. So we let our little differences be tempered by our overall agreement on the big picture.
That was from yesterday's episode of Live the Promise with Susie Larson. Coming up on today's episode, Susie will speak with Pastor Pete Wilson as he talks about choosing faith over anxiety. It's on the Live the Promise program, weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 p.m. Central from the Faith Radio Network. It's 58 past the hour. I'm Austin Hill. Still to come, we must talk about the presidential races in America. We'll get to that. SRN Headline News on the way next from the Faith Radio Network.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
Good morning. It's now 4 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to have you with us. Thank you for listening. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time, as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. I want to thank you for being here, first and foremost. Thank you for your support of Faith Radio. I want to issue somewhat of a warning. And I want to make too big of a deal of this, but I do want to just put it out there that in moments, like in the next 3 to 4 minutes or so, we will take on a subject matter that I suspect is going to upset some. And if it is upsetting to you, well, I think it should be. I hope nobody hears this news and listens to what is going to be discussed here and says, oh, well, that's nice. Let's go check the sports scores. This is a sign of the age in which we live. But it may challenge your thinking about politics and public policy and the governance of our nation and the laws that we live in. Dr. David Stevens, MD, medical doctor from the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He's also an ethicist, by the way. Highly educated man. He'll be joining us coming up in just moments to weigh in on this. But there have been some just stunning, not altogether surprising, because at least I've been watching the realm of biomedical ethics in our country, and I've been kind of seeing the trends over the last several years. I was in graduate school back in the 90s studying biomedical ethics, among other things, in a seminary, and I've seen the direction of other countries. But there is news out that it would appear as though under the federal Obamacare law, healthcare providers and insurance companies that reimburse physicians for their services, they can deny treatment to severely disabled children. In other words, let severely disabled children just simply die. That's where this pathway that we're on, that's where it leads. Dr. David Stevens is set to take this on in just moments here. We'll have him on the line here in about another 3 or 4 minutes. Lord willing, everything technologically works properly. This is profoundly important, and it should be a wake-up call, bar none. But I know we've talked about some of these biomedical issues before here on this program, and I've been resoundingly criticized for bringing them to your attention. Please, I hope that you will listen with an open mind and an open heart to what Dr. David Stevens has to say and the nature of our conversation. Very important stuff. We'll get to that coming up in just moments. Also, in just about half an hour from now, we welcome back Dr. Kent Kaiser, Kent Kaiser, Ph.D. He is a professor here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's where our Faith Radio Network is headquartered. Dr. Kaiser, a professor of speech communication. He will weigh in on some of the rhetoric that we're hearing from three particular presidential candidates who all jumped into the fray to run to be the next president of the United States, kind of all at the same time. Actually, I guess technically, we're anticipating one of these gentlemen. In fact, Aaron, do we have the audio mashup here? Okay, these are three candidates. You can probably identify most of them even when and where they don't identify themselves by name. I would just note for you that within the last 18 months, every one of these candidates have been guests here on the Faith Radio Network talking about books that they authored, books that had a theological and Christian underpinning to them. All three of them you've heard before on Faith Radio, perhaps. But here are the three candidates who kind of all at the same time, all within about 48 hours' time, said, oh, and by the way, I'd like to be president. Roll it.
Our founders never intended us to have a professional political class. They believed that citizens and leaders needed to step forward. We know the only way to reimagine our government is to reimagine who is leading it. I'm Carly Fiorina, and I'm running for president.
I will announce on May the 5th in my hometown of Hope, Arkansas, what my plans are going to be. And I'll let everybody just say, come to Hope on May the 5th. You'll find out what's going to happen.
Now, I've introduced my family. You say, well, who are you? I'll tell you. I'm Ben Carson, and I'm a candidate for president of the United States.
And the crowd went wild. Dr. Ben Carson, M.D., by the way, I would have you know. And that middle voice in there is former governor, former pastor, Mike Huckabee. And what you heard there, he was announcing that he was announcing. That was very clever. Yeah, so we're anticipating a more formal official announcement. I'm running for president coming up later today. All three of those individuals who have been guests here on the Faith Radio Network over the last 18 months or so, all three of them are, I would say, very out in the open about their Christian faith and their church affiliations. Dr. Kent Kaiser will analyze what's going on and why, perhaps, they feel compelled to bring their discussions of church and theology into the presidential campaigns. And is that a good thing? We'll get to that coming up in about half an hour from now, so stand by. When we return, biomedical ethics challenges abound. Dr. David Stevens, M.D., the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, he weighs in on one that, well, for some will be shocking. We'll talk about it next here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. It's 10 minutes after. It's now 11 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to have you with us as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. No, we don't shrink from the current events of our time. We talk about them and see them through the lenses of our Christian faith. In a radio interview recently, Dr. Pete Singer, a professor of ethics at the esteemed Princeton University, announced that he believes it is reasonable for government and private insurance companies to deny health care treatment to severely disabled children. Singer also contended that the federal health care system put together under the Obamacare law should be more overt about rationing health care and states that it is indeed seeking to ration health care. How do we wrap our minds around this? Dr. David Stevens, MD, he currently serves as the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He is also an ethicist. He has weighed in on these biomedical ethical dilemmas before. We welcome him back to the program. Dr. Stevens, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be with you, Austin. How are you doing this morning?
I am well. Disturbing news from an esteemed professor from an esteemed university, but you're no stranger to these dilemmas. What's going on here as you see it?
Well, Peter Singer's worse than you even imagine. He, his background, he's from Australia, actually, and has been at Princeton for a good number of years. Here's a quote from him that'll even make you shudder more. A week-old baby is not a rational and self-conscious being. And there are many non-human animals whose rationality, self-consciousness, awareness, capacity to feel pain, and so on, exceed that of a human baby a week, month, or even a year old. If the fetus does not have the same claim to life as a person, it appears that the newborn baby is of less value than a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee.
Mm-hmm.
And he advocates for infanticide. In other words, with these babies that have problems, or even to the point to say, well, if the parents don't like what they got, take it back to the hospital and have it euthanized.
Take it back to the hospital and have the child euthanized in a place of health care? Are you serious about this?
Absolutely. In fact, one of his cohorts down in Australia has called this afterbirth abortion. In other words, if you can abort beforehand, why can't you abort afterwards? He's a utilitarian. He thinks human worth is based on the fact of what capabilities you have, your ability to feel pain, to feel pleasure. That's what makes you a person. He would say, oh, yes, the unborn baby is a human being,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a person, and therefore you can do anything you want with it. Now, take that to the other end. He also says, if you get Alzheimer's disease or you have a stroke or whatever, you can't really interact with your environment very well and feel pain and pleasure, then you can just be killed. And one of his cohorts, a man named Frey at the Hastings Institute, says, yes, and we should get some good out of that. Let's just harvest organs from these people, take their life by organ transplantation, do it on the operating table, and euthanize them.
There's your utilitarian value. You weren't worthy of actually growing into adulthood, but we sure can use your kidneys. Thank you, child.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, in Holland, they're working on a protocol to do this. And in Canada, where they just legalized through their high court euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, already they're proposing, well, let's get some good out of these people that are terminally ill and want to take their lives. Let's transplant their organ and have death by transplantation.
Dr. David Stevens, he is a medical doctor. He's the president of the CMDA, the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He's on our news line here on Faith Radio. Dr. Stevens, what do you make of these comments made from the good Princeton professor about the federal Obamacare law, the federal takeover in many respects of the healthcare industry, the medical profession, the insurance industry? It has seemed pretty clear to me over these last several years that one of the objectives here, whether they want to use the term or not, it's rationing. It's denying health care to certain people and extending it to certain others. Somebody in Washington, D.C. will decide who gets treatment and who doesn't, all for the sake of, quote-unquote, saving money. What do we need to know about this? What's your perspective on this?
Well, they created a board made up of non-physicians, which they have not instituted yet since there's been such backlash on it, but essentially to say here's what we'll pay for and here's what we won't pay for, based on utility. Now, you know, the problem with issues like this is there's a little bit of truth and a lot of problem. You know, does healthcare cost too much? Yes. Is the biggest problem in the United States that healthcare costs too much? Yes. Do we need to get costs lowered? Yes. Are we going to be able to do everything everybody wants all the time, even if it has very little chance of success?
Mm-hmm.
No, because we're going to go bankrupt. But when you begin to say that you're going to make decisions about life and death situations with people where things can be of benefit just based on cost, then you start getting into some real difficult areas, and those that get the short end of that stick are those at both ends of life with severe medical problems, As we've already seen in some of the physician-assisted suicide debate in Oregon, they have a rationing system in Oregon. They have a list of 200 illnesses that they'll actually cover. And if you have less than a 5% chance of something being successful and being helpful and helping you to live for 5 years, then they will not give you Medicaid funds to do that. And they wrote a letter, Lynn Cheney, and she asked for an exemption so she could get cancer treatment. And they wrote back to her and said, no, but we will pay for your physician-assisted suicide. So, yeah, this type of thing is coming, and unfortunately we're seeing it in our country where life is devalued. And I think, Austin, one of the big things is how do we as Christians defend life? And maybe that's what we should turn to.
Let's do that when we come back, because... Well, we have brought this on ourselves, I would say, as Americans. We voted for a government takeover of these kinds of things, and this is the direction it's now going. Let's talk about an appropriate response when we continue. Dr. David Stevens, MD, he's the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. We'll continue on this, a very difficult subject, in moments. Don't go anywhere. 18 past the hour. It's now 19 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Dr. David Stevens, MD, he's the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He's on our newsline addressing some very serious ethical and moral dilemmas facing certainly Christians, but really all of us here in the United States of America. Dr. Stevens, given what you have told us here, these very startling and disturbing new developments, I guess, many of which result from the federal administration and takeover of healthcare in America. What's the thoughtful Christian to do in response?
Well, first of all, we need to understand how we defend this from the Bible, and the Bible tells us that we are not animals. We're made in God's image. He gave us dominion over animals, not like Peter Singer, who we were talking about, says we're just a higher form of animal. Because of that, since that nature that God has given us, we know there is a God. Worked in Africa for years and never saw animals putting together a place of worship. They have no capability of doing that. Because we have his essence, we can fellowship with him, and he wants to fellowship with us. That happened in the garden, and after sin in the garden, he actually created a fellowship offering to restore that. Also, we have a conscience. We know right from wrong. God gave us that. You know, as an Africa's missionary, a lion would kill somebody or a hippo would bite somebody. They didn't feel bad about it afterwards. But human beings have a conscience. And to a lesser degree, we have God-like capabilities. We have self-awareness. We have rationality. We have the ability to love, the ability to communicate at a high level. Mm-hmm. We have God's capacities at a lesser degree. So all of this makes us, that's what it means to be human. We are not just animals. But how do you defend that in the public marketplace? You can't do that with Bible verses in this day and time. But even our own Declaration of Independence says men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, mm-hmm. right, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And endowed means God has given this to us. No person, no government, no court, no Congress can take that away from us. It's a God-given right, and you work from that point to bring this defense for human life. So Peter Singer says we are potential persons. God says we are persons with potential from the moment of conception.
Very, very interesting. Dr. Stevens, I don't recall if it was late last year or earlier this year, but in a previous episode of the program, you were a guest here, and we talked about some very disturbing remarks made in an editorial, very high-profile editorial written by Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel with the Centers for Disease Control. Now, I don't want to confuse listeners right now and get into too many different doctors and names and such, but this man, a medical doctor of prominence and influence, was saying that, hey, he wants to just die at age whatever it was, 73 or 75, because arbitrarily he said, I will have
you know, fulfilled my life's wishes, and I'll just be a drain on society. I won't any longer be contributing to society. I just want to die when I reach my earlier mid-70s, and all the rest of us should want to die at that point in our lives so we don't consume more than we produce. Again, taking this kind of utilitarian view of the human person. I know after that conversation that we had and some of the exposition of that and some of my own remarks, had some people in the medical profession itself very upset. People emailing me saying, well, I'm a nurse and I would never send somebody off to die. Or I'm a physician's assistant and that just wouldn't happen where I work. And some people are very personally offended by that. Speak to the healthcare professional themselves, whether their title is MD or RN or what have you. Speak to that professional and tell them about what's going on in your own profession, if you would.
Well, ideas have consequence, and unfortunately these ethical ideas coming out are being taught to medical students and nurses and others in training, and I talk to the students where this happens. I wouldn't take someone's life either, but there's more and more pressure. What's being done now is the term medical futility. In other words, we're not going to give this treatment because it's medically futile. Now, there is a such thing as medical futility, and there's things when we should not give a treatment or at least discuss that with the patient because the benefit is not there. But if you're basing those issues on cost, if you are deciding we're not going to take care of this person because they don't have the money to pay for it, then you get into real problems. And this is happening increasingly in hospitals across the country. And then the physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, is going on even in states where it's not legal. I remember a nurse who walked up to California and said, I have a doctor in ICU that's killing patients. I said, what's he doing? He says he just gives them increasing doses of morphine when they don't even feel pain till he kills them. So unfortunately, yes, we need to stand for life. We need to stand for it adamantly in the workplace as healthcare professionals. But this whole idea that worth is based on your capacity, your capabilities to do things, is beginning to permeate our culture and permeate healthcare. And that is dangerous, and it's dangerous for us as healthcare professionals, more so for our patients.
Dr. David Stevens, president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. Find him and his associations at cmda.org. Read up, get studied up on these all-important issues. Dr. David Stevens, we are a voice of reason in troubled times. Thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Good to be with you, Austin.
Always a pleasure, sir. Very serious matter. I do hope you'll get to their website. We'll have all this info, by the way, on our network website a little bit later this morning at myfaithradio.com. 26 past the hour. I'm Austin Hill.
News you can use. Connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
36 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill here weekday mornings as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful right here at the start of your day. As many Americans are feeling as though our country needs a very serious discussion about the role of Christian faith in our governance, and Christian faith is missing from our culture, in comes a slew of people who would like to be our next U.S. president. And while they come from some very eclectic church backgrounds, they talk about God and faith rather openly. Case in point, note these three candidates.
Our founders never intended us to have a professional political class. They believed that citizens and leaders needed to step forward. We know the only way to reimagine our government is to reimagine who is leading it. I'm Carly Fiorina, and I'm running for president.
I will announce on May the 5th in my hometown of Hope, Arkansas, what my plans are going to be. And I'll let everybody just say, come to Hope on May the 5th. You'll find out what's going to happen.
Now, I venture this to my family. You say, well, who are you? I'll tell you. I'm Ben Carson, and I'm a candidate for president of the United States.
And the crowd went wild. Those voices, by the way, just to recap, that's former executive Carly Fiorina, MBA, former governor Mike Huckabee, MDiv, he's Master of Divinity, former pastor, and Dr. Benjamin Carson, MD, all vying for the presidency. Joining us to talk about this eclectic bunch, this is his term to describe this, Dr. Kent Kaiser, professor here at University of Northwestern St. Paul,
This is, from an analysis vantage point, this is pretty fascinating stuff. Welcome back to the program. Tell us what you think is going on.
Interesting collection of people for anybody who's interested in that intersection of politics and religion. We've got quite a diverse collection of people on the Republican side who have already jumped into the race.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at the ones that you just played, Fiorina is interesting in that she was raised Episcopalian, has kind of not been a regular churchgoer, but certainly ties her political stances to religious beliefs and talks about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. But mm-hmm. she and her husband don't regularly attend church, apparently. But she, with each of her positions on abortion and same-sex marriage and so on, she really ties these things very directly to religion. Looking at Mike Huckabee, he's interesting because, of course, he used to be a Baptist pastor.
Right.
Now, he's also said, you know, you can't only win, you know, you can't just win with the religious vote and you can't just win on the social issues. I think the challenge for him is having been a very specific type of pastor, you know, the question will be, can he reach out more broadly to Christians and religious people in general? And then with Carson, interesting, and I don't know much about this religion, I must say, but he's a Seventh-day Adventist and ties many of his policies to faith, and also says he's prayed before each surgery, and so he seems to have an active faith in his day-to-day life. But he, too, has said that, you know, we should... It's interesting, he said that we should not be having a religion interjected into political matters, but he does it at every turn. So so those are those three. I think they're all very interesting. And we could talk about, there's also the other candidates who have already declared. Jeb Bush is interesting in that, of course, he was raised Episcopalian, you know, and was part of that with the rest of his family, but then 20 years ago became a Catholic, which is what his wife was. And he has talked about how he's, you know, he very much appreciates sort of the tradition and the ritualistic aspects of Catholicism. The big question that he's facing now is that typical, what we call the Catholic question, that, you know, candidates all the way back to Kennedy and even before that faced, which is, to what extent will he be favoring policies that the Pope or the Catholic Church favor, and specifically in his case, people are questioning the position on immigration because the Pope has said nobody should live in the shadows, and so, you know, what are the implications of that for things like amnesty and for future immigration? And then Rubio, also, who has announced, is from also from Florida Lake Bush, is interesting in that he is now Catholic. However, when he's in Florida, he attends a Baptist megachurch, and for a time as a child, he was a Mormon. He was actually baptized first as Catholic and then later as a Mormon, and for a time he was a very strong Mormon as a child, but now he seems to also, like Bush, to express a lot of appreciation for the ritualistic and sort of traditional parts of Catholicism, which, you know, could tie him in to maybe a broader faith view. I think of all the candidates we're talking about, I think Rubio is the most interesting in this faith journey or this religion journey that he's had. It's been pretty broad.
It sure sounds that way. Dr. Kent Kaiser, professor here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, where the Faith Radio Network is headquartered. He's in the studio with us on the Austin Hill in the Morning program, talking about the proliferation, if you will, of faith-based rhetoric, if you will, and the rhetoric that's emerging from the presidential candidates. Let me take a step backwards here for a moment and get your thoughts on something. It strikes me that if I look at American history just over the course of my lifetime, which pretty closely corresponds to yours, I suspect, as well, there has emerged over the course of our lives this enormous voter bloc, in political terms, called Evangelical Christian America. a voter bloc that once didn't exist as a voter bloc because evangelical Christians, by and large, just didn't participate in elections. There's this huge awakening in 1972 amid cultural upheaval, and evangelicals turned out in huge numbers and delivered President Richard Nixon just an overwhelming, almost embarrassingly large reelection victory. They kind of went back into the shadows for a while. Evangelicals came out again in large numbers in, 1976 and voted for Democrat President Carter, Jimmy Carter, and then kind of shifted over to the Republican side of the aisle, helped reelect twice, elect and reelect President Reagan, George H.W. Bush. Then they kind of shifted over again, the evangelical voter bloc, some numbers of them anyway, went with President Bill Clinton and then George W. Bush pretty strongly and then to Barack Obama. I mean, the point is this, the bulk of evangelical Christians who care to vote, they've shifted back to the left and to the right over the course of my lifetime as I see it. And it just seems to me like candidates on the left and right now, they will just say whatever they think they need to say to appeal to those voters. I hope that's not too cynical, but do you agree with that thumbnail sketch, and is that what's going on? A huge appeal right now in primary season to get evangelical Christians engaged.
I do agree to the what you were saying about the candidates have to appeal to evangelical and Christian voters. I think that it would be very difficult for any presidential candidate to come along and say that he or she had no faith, or that they weren't a Christian to be elected in the first place. And so I think, especially with the current president, we've at least seen lip service given. Now, I think in prior candidacies, I think like with Bush, with Clinton, with the first Bush, with Reagan, and so on, there was a real faith behind it. I do believe that, and I think that the mark of the successful candidates has been that they have actually had outreach to various groups. I can remember, for example, when George W. Bush was first going to run, one of his staffers came and sought me out when I was working at the Secretary of State's office at the time here in Minnesota, and they were asking me, because they knew that I'd worked at the Minnesota Family Council, I was kind of tied into different faith communities, specifically asking me who they should contact in our state to tap into the Catholic vote. And of course, I knew someone who was kind of, I guess you'd call Stemwinder or whatever, somebody who was a real activist who could motivate and mobilize people to vote. And George Bush, by the way, won the Catholic vote across the country by about 5%. Fast forward to when Romney was running, he actually lost by about 5% the first time, 2% the second time, among the Catholic vote. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just looking at that block of voters. And it's the same kind of thing with evangelicals. There has to be a specific effort made. And so that's why I think when we look at these candidates, we have to say, we really have to look broadly and say, who's going to be able to reach out to these diverse groups?
Yeah. Let's pick it up there. A quick break. We'll continue in just a moment with Dr. Kent Kaiser, professor here at University of Northwestern St. Paul. Some thoughts on what's really going on with this huge plethora of presidential candidates, and why are they talking so overtly, so prolifically in some cases, about their Christian faith and the teachings of Christ. We'll continue in just moments. It's now 46 past the hour. I'm Austin Hill. It's the Faith Radio Network. Don't go away. Minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, here weekday mornings, and I'm glad you're with us now. Dr. Kent Kaiser, PhD, professor here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, here where our network is headquartered. He's giving us some analysis on the rhetoric emerging from the presidential candidates. So, Dr. Kaiser, what does all of this mean? I mean, this is, to me, it's just fascinating. I'm not laughing because I'm not taking this seriously. It is very serious. I'm glad that there's an open discussion about biblical values and the Christian faith and how it should impact our culture and our public policy. But when you described earlier this morning the candidates as representing a very eclectic bunch, it really is. What should this tell us? What should we be looking for?
Well, I think the point, with looking at the candidates' politics and their in the intersection of that with their faith is, you know, their faith is going to inform their politics, and we know that, and I think we accept that. In fact, I think we often appreciate that. The question is, you know, exactly how much of the politics do we want, you know, really open, I guess, out there, and how much can you have of that and win the race? And I think, again, we need to look at candidates who have the right values and then who can reach out among diverse groups of diverse religious groups, I should say. And you just look at, like, the Midwest. You know, we're about one-third Catholic, about one-third Lutheran, and about one-third something else. Mm-hmm. And a candidate needs to be able to kind of come in and grab the lion's share of each of those groups in order to win. And so I think as we look at the faith backgrounds of the candidates, you know, we'd be wise to look at people who maybe have had a little bit of, you know, breadth of experience themselves, or mm-hmm. who have some appreciation for faiths that are a little different from their own, you know, if they're not Catholic, for that, you know, section of the country, for example, you know. So I think that's what we want to look for, is like the values and the policies and how they're guided by politics, and not so much the specific faith that the candidate has.
Yeah, and I appreciate what you're saying about looking to the candidates to try to discern their stated values and see those values in their stated policies. Former Governor Jeb Bush, in particular, indeed, his family background is in the Episcopalian Church. His father, former President G.H.W. Bush, was Episcopalian. Both the sons, former President George W. Bush, he left the Episcopalian church and became an evangelical for all intents and purposes. Jeb Bush, as you pointed out, left Episcopalianism and became Catholic. I wonder, does Jeb Bush run into trouble with voters in as much as while he professes his Catholicism, his policy statements on, just a couple of controversial things, like, for example, abortion and the definition of marriage, his stated policies on those are at odds with Catholic teaching. He may resonate with a lot of modern-day Catholics, but he's not on board with the Church at Rome with those things, I don't think. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, and again, that's another realm, looking at their policies and how they match up with their faith background. I think in the case of Bush and Rubio, the people who have already run for office, we have sort of a track record of how they've done among different faith groups. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can look at that and say, okay, here's how we might expect them to perform nationally. And I think, on the other hand, with like Fiorina and Carson, they haven't been elected, and so we kind of have to wonder what would happen, and we have to all we have is like experience from the past to go on of how we think they might do. Now, Huckabee's interesting because he was a pastor and did get elected in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. We have to look at that and say, to what extent would Arkansas sort of represent the rest of the country, and, you know, would he be able to replicate his success in Arkansas more nationally? And so I think those are the kinds of things we kind of need to look for in a very pragmatic sense.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kaiser, what advice would you offer to pastors in particular about engaging with the process of electing another president, rather, and being aware of who's doing what and those kinds of things? What advice would you offer in terms of things to watch for?
Well, I think, first of all, pastors can be much more engaged in the process than they seem to think they can. I know that, you know, liberals particularly would love to say, oh, a pastor can't get involved, or we're going to take away their nonprofit status, and they're going to have to pay taxes on what the church brings in. And a lot of that's just not true. And so pastors can be much more involved in, you know, mobilizing people and speaking what they believe, even from the pulpit. And I think that's just fine. Especially when it comes to, you know, biblical values that are very closely tied to policies. You know, the pastor should be vocal on those issues. Maybe not specifically about which candidates to vote for, but, you know, when it comes around to an election, anybody who's sitting in a pew in a church should not have a question of how that church doctrine would line up with the candidate's views.
Mm-hmm. And for the thoughtful layperson who's trying to think for themselves and make sense of it all, things to watch for.
Unfortunately, a lot of the lay people are left to kind of do the research for themselves. It's going to be nice if the pastors would, you know, be a lot more explicit about how different candidates' political views line up with the doctrine of their church.
Mm-hmm.
And as a lay person, you have to do a lot of work, unfortunately, or else you're going by these sort of peripheral cues, which is, oh, what religion is so-and-so? Well, that's maybe not the best way to look at it, because people will profess a faith and not necessarily take that and apply it to the policies. You know, I think we've seen that with some recent elections, where people give lip service to being Christian, and then that doesn't necessarily line up with the policy stances that they take. So
sure.
The layperson has to be very discerning, you know, about how the policies line up with the faith or the doctrine behind it, and not so much, I think, concerned about what specific religion, whether it's Catholic or evangelical, whether it's Baptist or Lutheran or whatever it might be. I think we have to look very specifically at how the specific politician's faith informs their policy decisions.
It sounds like you're saying implicitly, Dr. Kaiser, that indeed there might be a candidate out there for any public office, perhaps presidents is what we're talking about now, might be a candidate who does not profess or indeed emulate a connection to the kind of church that I might go to, the kind of church that I belong to, but they nonetheless may emulate policies and values that are consistent with my faith. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, and I think we saw this, you know, it was very interesting when, you know, with Mitt Romney, I think we actually saw this happen over time where, you know, more and more evangelicals sort of got on his side when they realized this particular point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Dr. Kent Kaiser, he is a professor here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. Final question, just a few seconds left. Do you believe that, I know for a lot of people this is just a long ways off and not even thinking about the next election for the presidency right now, do you believe that evangelical Christians will become more engaged this time around or less engaged than perhaps the last couple of elections?
I think they'll be much more engaged.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Kaiser. Good to see you. We'll look forward to talking again soon, and I hope you'll come back. Perhaps we can schedule next week and talk about the candidates on the left side of the aisle and analyze that for us.
Sounds good to me.
Look forward to it. Thanks very much. And thank you for listening. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, here weekday mornings, early mornings. Find us on myfaithradio.com. You'll find the interview guests that we spoke with and so much more right there. See you tomorrow morning at 6. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.